Hi, Stephen, or Steve. Welcome to Airhex FM.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me.
We had already Shai Almok. I think you know him, right?
Yeah, I know Shai. We work together, Codename One.
Yeah, exactly.
Many
years ago. And I think I met you both at Java One also many years ago.
Oh, did you? Oh, I went to Java One. It would have been around, was it 2012? Was it
something like this? Yeah. What I remember, I had something to do with Codename One, or maybe with Swink or JavaFX. And you both were, you looked like, you know, like lawyers dressed like crazy. And I think you had something like a pitch talk or whatever. Could it be that you had some, you know, some meetings regarding financing or whatever? Because I don't know why. I just remember that. And I think we had something to do with each other before that.
I'm not sure. I don't have a memory of that. I'm sure that I didn't have any, you know, financial stuff at Java One.
Codename One or whatever. So not the Java One. I know that I met you or Shai, and I wanted to talk to you of Codename. It's like, no, we have no time because we have an important meeting, whatever. So, okay, then go ahead.
No time.
Yeah. It was just 14 years ago, and you cannot remember.
Yeah. You might be thinking of Chen.
Maybe.
Because, Codename One is a creation of Shai and Chen.
And maybe it was Chen.
So they're like the main moguls, and I was the first hire.
Okay. Then was maybe Hen, because this was okay. Okay,
because but I was wearing a T-shirt when I went to Java One.
Okay, then because otherwise, if in Twitter, I wouldn't invite you to, you know, to podcast if
you'd known about the T-shirt. Yeah,
T-shirt is very best. I also have a T-shirt. Look. So, question: what is your first computer?
Apple 2GS.
Wow, I think you had the first one. With such a machine, and what you did with the computer? Why you got it?
Well, it was my parents got mm-hmm. it. It was like the first family computer, mm-hmm. and I mean, we did get some games. They had those things that you could go to. It was like a sort of a you bring your blank discs, and mm-hmm. They've got all the games, and you load it up with a bunch of things. I played.
Was it a floppy disc?
They were the big, the 5 1/4. So all the games that we got through there were actually kind of lame. I think they were like mostly like text-based games. There was a few, because I was like 6 or 7 and my dad didn't know anything about computers. So we went in and we got a whole bunch. So that was fun. I did have one game that I like saved up and bought. It was a Hardball. By I can't remember who did that game. It was Bob Whitehead's Hardball. Mm-hmm. It's been ported to a whole bunch of things, and I spent a lot of time playing that. Like I kept mm-hmm. stats for all the players and everything.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that you said your games were lame, because I had all my games were on a cassette, and they were actually great. I cannot remember I had a text-based game back then. Maybe I had, but what I remember, just cool games. And I had a ZX Spectrum, so it was even worse than your Apple, I think. Which year was it, roughly?
I'm guessing around 86.
Yeah, same here. So that's interesting that, you know, Apple, maybe there were no games on Apple back then.
Well, they did. Like, my Hardball game was really good. Like, I had to save up. It was like $60. Which at the time
was it like with colors and sound or text based?
Yeah, it had colors, it had sound, yeah, it had the umpire saying strike, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, super cool. And okay, and you in how you stopped playing or gaming and start, you know, something, I don't know, scripting, programming or whatever, how it happened?
Well, I guess when I was a kid, I had an uncle who programmed things, and so I knew.
Where was it? Was it in US?
This is in Canada.
Hey, cool. Mm-hmm.
And so he programmed in assembly language, and wow. So I knew this was a possibility, but I didn't do any assembly back then. I had a couple books where it had a basic, and you could, you know, copy some, some very simple things in, but I wouldn't say I actually did much programming back then. I didn't really start programming until 1997, like after I graduated high school and the advent of the web. And really, I just wanted to make web pages. And then so I got into Perl and then CGI and Flash.
Wow.
And then PHP. It was just like I'd spend all my – I worked at Future Shop.
The cool story is actually one of my first jobs or side jobs, because I never worked for a company, but a client asked me about CGI, and I look at that and I said, this is really hard. And all I knew is Java back then. And what I found is that CGI, this common gateway interface, was not secure. So I told my client, hey, look, this is not secure, so we should use Java for it. And this is not why, and so we did servlets in Java, because all I knew is Java, and was too lazy to learn Perl. Actually, I bought a Perl book, and I still have it. It was with a Camel, I think. Is it possible? A Camel book from O'Reilly?
They used to make some like Perl handbooks and stuff, and they'd always have pictures of camels.
Yeah,
on
but
it.
I think it was Camel. And I wanted to read it, but I never managed to. And I think now it's just 25 years old or something like this. And since then was Java, basically. So interesting. And the CGI, how it works is, I think you, the Apache web server just invoked the CGI script and passed you the environment variables or something like this, right?
More or less. Like CGI, I think, is just the generic name for the interface of how you take a web request and make it available to a script. So like there's all those things when you're printing out the environment, it's got the query string, you know, that's when I started with Perl, and I guess they already had libraries out, but all of the tutorials, the very first thing that you learned how to do was parse the query string. So like you do the regular expression, or you do a split on the ampersand and then a split on the equals, and there now you've got your dictionary or your map of what the user has requested. And that's basically CGI.
What I remember, I read a book back then, Java book about servlets, and it was on kettle, tea kettle or something on it. This is what I remember. I have to look it up. So I'm just good that we talk about that. And CGI-bin, so I remember the folder. Yeah. And Java was faster than CGI. You know why? Back then, this was my first CGI was not secure, because the script could just do whatever, right? It's very similar to LLM tools right now, actually. But you know why Java was faster? You know it.
Well,
right?
the startup time, because the CGI has to start the binary every time. That's actually what led me to PHP when I started PHP, because I was doing PHP and I was doing Java at the same time, but more on the PHP.
And what do you like more?
PHP was because I was just learning. Java felt harder.
So we can stop the podcast right now, right?
But I guess this is a Java podcast. I shouldn't talk too much about PHP.
No. It's just I don't care. It's just fun. So
PHP, because when you're coming from Perl, PHP felt like it was going from a horse into a car. Like they had all these hard things that were in Perl. PHP felt like it was like, oh, we don't need those. Let's make this easier.
And is actually PHP and Perl related somehow, or they have nothing to do with each other?
There must have been some influence, like the dollar sign for the variable. Yeah. I mean, that's PHP was very familiar coming from Perl, and it just sort of cleaned up a lot of. It's kind of like going from C++ to Java. Like no more you're having to, you know, parse your query strings. It's just like, oh, these show up as just global variables. Of course, a lot of these things that were nice, years later they became anti-patterns. So like don't use the global variables pulled in, and there was all kinds of vulnerabilities because of it. But PHP was very nice to use back then, and frankly, PHP has evolved really nicely too. like in there's a lot of features that if you get used to working in PHP and then you go back to Java for a project, you miss names.
Yeah, what I remember at a German conference, I don't know why, but they invited PHP guys, and I was a part of a panel. But what they did, they had more enterprise patent than we had, actually. I said, you are crazy. They had factories and everything. They had so many patents. I thought, you know, PHP is easy. And then I was told this was part of a framework. I forgot the name of PHP framework, which is like an enterprise framework. And I said, this is actually interesting because everyone says, you know, Java is complicated. But what you did with the framework, this is beyond complicated. But I forgot there was PHP...
Marvel. How is Symfony.
Called? Not Symfony. What else? Yeah, Symfony.
Laravel.
Maybe, but Laravel is a newer one, right? And this was...
It is a newer one.
This was 10 years old at least. So Laravel, I only heard good things. But this framework, indeed, it had really factories and adapters, whatever we hated in Java was in the framework there. So forgot about that. But it was the Enterprise Framework PHP. So I will look it up. Enterprise.
We use a lot of PHP at my current job. I work at a place called CloudBeds mostly right now as my main gig. And I was surprised when I started there because it was mostly a PHP shop when I pulled in, and I was surprised at the level of enterprise PHP that's going on there, because at the time, I had done mostly Java for enterprisey stuff and PHP for quick and dirty stuff. And so then when I went in there and saw that, oh, it's actually PHP is a real serious language.
Facebook
for enterprise
is built
things.
On PHP, right? They had.
Facebook started on PHP and they have had to innovate to get performance out of it. Like they came up with that, I think it was called Hip Hop. They compile PHP down to C++.
Zend. I think it was Zend.
Oh, Zend. Yeah, okay. Well, they're the guys that do PHP. Like they're the PHP company.
I think. And I opened a page.
That's right. Yeah, Zend framework. And they've got a bunch of
And they have core patents, every engineer master, and they are talking about adapter, proxy, command, mediator, and lots of patents, but this is older from 2025 actually. So this surprises me because in Java, I mean,
PHP has evolved to be so similar to Java that I mean, if you're familiar with one, it's really easy to step into the other.
But what's cool, there were lots of PHP people in my Java courses, and what I could impress them was connection pooling. So a data source and collect, they were delighted. I said, this is interesting because I know every Java developer knows that and no one is really surprised, but everyone liked data sources and connection pooling. So I already knew. It's like, if you're a PHP developer, I show you something, show a data source, and they were delighted. Wow, that's really cool. It's like, yeah, we have it for 20 years already. Now, I think, you know, everything converges is a little bit my opinion. So they we learn from
a good idea is a good idea everywhere.
Yeah. What happens is it happens exactly the same with .NET. So .NET came later, and what I observed is that the .NET guys saw Java and they mostly copied the bad things. This is all the patents, you know, all the stuff which is optional was copied. And it's like, why are you, you know, replicating all the patents? And even invited the own patents on top of the others. So I remember in one German conference, one .NET guy, I remember the talk was about, they used the Gang of Four patents. And they were mapped to biological patents. I remember he would like cells and organisms and everything. So yeah, but I mean, this is we don't have it in Java, like, you know, organism and cell, whatever. No one talks about that like this. And it was an interesting talk, but a little bit exaggerated. So yeah. And JavaScript was the same, basically. What I remember in JavaScript, they try to know, they wanted to have classes and inheritance. And I say, okay, but why? I mean, if you have, if you like, you know, functional programming, go with functional programming. Why you need, you know, object orientation from Java, because we have already Java. And now it's less so. But even React was object-oriented at the beginning, right? They had classes and, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It can take a while to sort of figure out the direction of, I mean, React, yeah. I think the hardcore React guys at my work don't seem to be interested in object-oriented.
No more. They had hooks, but back then it was class-based. So it was it looked like Java classes, right?
Yeah, I don't know if the JavaScript classes have caught on. I think it was just syntactic sugar, wasn't it? Like
maybe it's a little bit back right now because web components are Java classes and you have properties, for instance, so you don't need getters and setters anymore. You have private. So, I mean, this is strange in between because the hardcore JavaScript developers don't like classes, but they get more and more support for classes. So, this is what my observation
is. And I think
is.
A lot of the hardcore stuff is happening in TypeScript. At least all the guys, all of our front-end stuff right now is TypeScript.
Interestingly, I try to avoid TypeScript because if you do JavaScript with a little bit JS doc, Visual Studio Code treats that as TypeScript. So I get exactly the same, convenience, developer convenience without having any additional build tools. And interesting what happens with LLMs, because if LLMs are so good with JavaScript and web standards, I think the importance of web frameworks get a little bit less important. So, but let's see what happens. All right, because if you think about it, why we need a framework if LLM understands these standards? So why are we depending on framework, and maintain the dependencies if they just understand?
There's so many questions like that up in the air. Like I ported React to Java a couple weeks ago. Using TVM, like I created a library because I just for fun, I was like, well, I like the Java ecosystem. Let's work with this. But all the development, I mean, I did that largely using Claude. Mm-hmm. And when I'm using it, I'm largely using Claude. Like I'm telling Claude instead of, don't use React to build this, use TVM React and mm-hmm. build it in Java. And mm-hmm. so I'm not even really looking at the code much.
The question is why you need a framework or why you need TypeScript then? Because if you tell Claude Code use JavaScript with JS doc with types, you are forced to implement Java doc, which is a good thing even for LLMs because you can put more context information there, and you are not depending on anything. In my project, enterprise project, dependencies liability because we have to care, update, and so forth. No dependencies, no problems actually.
Yeah, that's true. I get the feel. My hunch is that the decisions will be more to do with bigger architectural things, like seeing long term as far as build this in Java versus build this in JavaScript. Claude's going to build either, and it's going to come out the first few versions. I mean, it'll be able to do it either way, but probably the difference will come in long term. When it comes to how do I want to deploy this? What other larger features need to integrate with it?
Yeah, but interestingly, there are studies how LLMs and how good current LLMs understand languages, and Java is like 87%, and JavaScript is like 60-70. So the LLMs generate better Java code than JavaScript. So if you would just consider that, then your direction is great, but the discussion is too interesting, so I will invite you back and we talk about this. So I'm just curious with your Apple. So you had some books about assembly. So how you started coding? You said 1997 during your university time. You wanted to implement some websites.
Yeah.
And then you learned Perl, PHP, Java, right? So this was the trajectory.
Perl, PHP. Flash was in there too early on.
You understood actually Flash?
Yeah, well, it was because before this, I had while I hadn't done much programming, I was really into BBSs and stuff. So some of the first stuff that I wanted to build using Perl mm-hmm. were essentially BBSs, which are kind of like content management systems. Mm-hmm. But because that was the example of what I wanted to build. And Flash at the time, that was around 1998, was really big. And the types of interfaces that you could build with Flash, you couldn't do. Like we didn't have HTML5. We didn't have JavaScript was very primitive. And so if you wanted a really cool interface, Flash was the ticket. And so Flash had ActionScript, which became something very similar to JavaScript.
Exactly. It should be actually JavaScript with types, but I tried to learn Flash, and what I never understood is the keyframes. Because you can only put code in the keyframes, and you never had the chance to see the entire code base. And this really confused me, because in Java, you know, everything was code, basically. And in Flash, you could only put in keyframes. Like, how it is working? I mean, why I have to wait until, you know, the keyframes appear? So for me, it was really confusing.
It was confusing. It's just like, it was just the way, and it started with animations. So there probably were best practices that I didn't know. So like, if I were to open anybody's Flash, there's a lot of clicking around. It's like, well, where are the things?
Yeah, exactly. And I knew somehow it could work, but I had no idea what to do. This was what I didn't like. In Java, it was more or less clear. Maybe, you know, we can shift around the methods or classes, but at least you had, if you will put everything to one Java file, you would find everything, or even multiple Java files is multiple Java files. But in Flash, it was really hard to find the code. You know, that's the problem.
I had the benefit of not knowing any better at the time. Like, I didn't. This was the first thing that I had really delved into for front end stuff. So
you remember Visual H for Java?
Visual H.
This was IDE from IBM. And it was Smalltalk based, and I had similar problem with that because you could only see methods. So if you click on a method, you saw source code for the method, but not the entire class. And the only way to see everything is to print it. So I printed actually some of my projects to understand better, you know, how everything fits together. And
I did that all the time. Like I still have, when I go out into like my parents' house and like old files, there's binders full of just source code that I printed out from either my own or projects that I would download. When I got into Perl, I downloaded a meta search engine because I wanted to create a search engine. And that's part of it was just going through line by line, print it out and try to figure out what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So similar story here. Okay. If we print, you know, stuff, then it's okay. Then it's understandable. Okay, so did Java and PHP at the same time? So you were a freelancer or what? How it worked?
I guess I did do freelancing, but a lot of it was just for my own. Like I did entrepreneurial things just out of high school. We did some promotional stuff that we would like make flyers for companies and send out. And I wanted to get involved in doing it on the web because the web was coming out and it was like, hey, you know, instead of having to pay 25 cents a flyer to get this thing built, we can send out millions for absolutely free, which is, there's a name for that now. It's called spam.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, the spam wasn't really well known or well understood, but, so just building the stuff for myself. And then I went to school at SF Simon Fraser University, where Java is the language that they teach you in Computing 101. And so Java
in Canada as well?
In Canada, yeah. And so Java became sort of the default language that everybody knew. I knew, everybody knew. You used it as a sort of as a reference to anything else. And if you're going to choose anything other than Java, you're justifying, well, why did you choose to use C++? It's like, well, because I was, you know, performance creating a game or whatever it was. But PHP still, I got a job actually at SFU while I was going to school there. And the job was like web coordinator and then as a web developer. And I used PHP for almost all that stuff because quick and dirty. Like I can really slap stuff together in PHP super quick. Java, it always felt like there was more. I just get it. I'd spend all my time creating class hierarchies before I'd finally get it to do anything. Whereas PHP, I go straight in and today I've got, you
because
know,
it's more like something. Style, right? You could just skip the entire class hierarchy and be as messy as you like with Java, but no one did it. This was the problem, I think. If you did Java, you were immediately, you know, associated in your peers were mostly, you know, people who just liked, you know, layers and design and inheritance and polymorphism, right? So, and it was harder to create a mess with Java.
It is. Well, I don't think you would have had fun. Like, you can create a quick and dirty thing in PHP, and just the way it works, it can actually be fun to work with up until it gets really big. Whereas Java, if you do quick and dirty, like if you skip the class, you know, developing your class hierarchy, and what are you using? Hash tables, vectors. It's going to be painful to work on immediately. Like, mm-hmm. your quick and dirty thing is going to be like, I hate this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make a class hierarchy. You're not going to do it.
Okay. That means Java encourages classes and PHP encourages maps.
Well, at the time it's very easy, like arrays and maps, they're all just like, you know, it's a variable and you can, you don't have to think too much about, this is going to be an array or it's going to be an object, and you didn't even have to worry about what information was going to be in there, and mm-hmm. you can iterate over it. And as long as you can keep it in your head, you're solid.
So you work for a man or you are a freelancer?
Well, at SFU, I worked for SFU, and then I'd always have a few, you know, side clients. I'd have, you know, my open source projects that I put on, well, before GitHub, it was
SourceForge.
It was SourceForge, and sometimes you wouldn't even
what open source project you had back then.
What's that?
What open source projects?
The big one that I poured a lot of time into was called ZetaFace, mm-hmm. which was ZetaFace, which is still around. I started that in 2005. And it's like a CRUD framework, so that you start, you build your database in MySQL, and then out of the box, like if you you've got sort of an idea of what your CRUD application is going to look like, and then there's just some configuration files to customize it further. Like, oh, by default, this text field, the edit form for it is going to be just a regular text area, but let's add the ability to add some validation with some configuration files, mm-hmm. or maybe let's make it so it's a WYSIWYG field. And so that it's sort of it grew up from there. And there was, for a time, there was a lot of people using it. There's still a few people using it, and I use it for a few things.
And how popular is it right now? Is it?
Oh, I don't think it's very popular. The website is in need of attention, which I think now with Claude, one of these days I'm going to tell Claude to fix up the website, make it more modern. Right now I'm going through and it's more of just maintenance.
It's beautiful. I'm on it now. It's
just, oh, really?
This is not even HTTPS, right?
It probably isn't. No. Yeah.
It isn't?
It probably isn't. I don't know.
Minimal? Essential, but, right? And yeah. But it says it is the fastest way to build front end for your MySQL database.
It, you know what? It can be. It absolutely can be. But I mean, probably I'd have to, I got to get some demos up to show more modern.
But the slides are nicer.
Are there slides? Yeah. I haven't looked at, let me see what it looks like right now.
You use Cloud Code, I guess, right?
Oh, for this?
No, not for that.
Yeah, I use Cloud Code and I use Codex. Mostly Cloud Code. I've been waffling back and forth, mm-hmm. but Cloud, for some reason, just seems like it gets me better results. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that can change. It changes all the time. I'm actually, I'm on parental leave right now. And mm-hmm. so I've been using the time to, well, take care of the kid, but also build sort of an IDE for myself that reflects how I code in 2026, which is totally changed. Like I've in the past been using, you know, the JetBrains IDEs for mm-hmm. PHP. I use PHP Storm. I use IntelliJ for Java. For Go, I use Goland. Mm-hmm. And those are still, I think, the best way to do coding. But I was finding that what I'm doing most of the time is I've got a whole bunch of repositories and I got a whole bunch of branches on those repositories, and I'm getting Claude to be working on branches of those. Mm-hmm. And so I might have, you know, seven or eight things going on at the same time on seven or eight different repositories, and sometimes seven or eight things in the same repository, but in different work trees. And so it was just getting out of control. I'd have, you know, five different IntelliJ windows open, mm-hmm. one for each project, you know, a few different Golang windows. It was really easy to lose track of things. And so I found that mostly I just want to work in the terminal with Cloud Code or mm-hmm. Codex. Mm-hmm. And I want those terminals to be organized mm-hmm. so that I can basically go into a repository and a branch, and that'll get me to the terminals that I've got, the sessions that I've got working on that branch, mm-hmm. and vice versa. I actually got that far in the IDE, and then I realized, well, I need to work on my flows that are more task based. In which case, I might actually be working on three or four different repos that are dependent on each other. Like I'll have an infra repo with some Terraform, and I'll have a back end repo, and I'll have a front end repo, mm-hmm. and I want Claude to be able to work on this task with all those three in the context. And
so you built your own terminal, or what you did?
Yeah, well, it's just Swing. And so I built, like, I started out with just vibe coded, essentially, mm-hmm. Because Swing, Claude, and Codex happen to be very good at. Mm-hmm. There's so many examples out there that they're trained mm-hmm. on. But yeah, I started out with just like, okay, well, I want to, on the left nav menu, I want all of all my repositories that, you know, tell you which repositories I want to have in my workspace. And then when I select a repository I want a master detail with the branches, a list of the branches on the top, filterable. And then on the bottom the branches, I want to have tabs, one for Claude, one for Codex, one for Docker, because I want to be able to run some stuff in dangerous mode. Mm-hmm. Then for each of those tabs, I can, you know, have multiple clods, multiple codexes. And that was the start. And it only, to get up to that point, it was less than a day. So like setting up your own IDE, it feels like I actually started to think, well, maybe I'll put this out as an open source project. Why not? It's like, this is great. But almost every name that I could think of for this, I would search and somebody else has made their other own IDE that does the same thing. And so the closest analogy I can come to for where we are is setting up your own IDE is kind of like it used to be setting up your own like bash scripts to help with your, you know, mm-hmm. making your bash environment more ergonomic.
I use Visual Studio Code, but I don't use multiple repositories at the same time, interestingly. So I tend to create new repositories for new projects and spend more time with it. So it's interesting that we work differently. But it's also my observation that LLMs are very good with JavaFX and with Swing. And I also wanted actually to talk about this with you, because my impression could be that the Swing and JavaFX could get a small revival, because it ships with Java. It's fast, looks nice, and LLMs know it. So it is. It could be actually, I know, an interesting thing to do. And what I do a lot right now, Java 25 ships with source mode or script support, so Shebang. So all my automation scripts are basically Java. And what I didn't thought is possible. So I have no idea about Python. So I understand Python a little bit, but I never wrote anything, any Python code. But if I have to extend something, so I migrate the Python script to Java. And in all cases so far, Java was shorter than Python. So this could be, this could happen because formatting or whatever. But what's even more impressive is that usually I didn't need any external dependencies with Java because everything was built in. And in Python, I always need it. This surprised me because I thought, you know, Python will come with a more out-of-the-box tooling. I even think regular expression or something. I had to port from Python to Java, and Java ships with regular expression. In Python, I had to use external library. So this really surprised me because I thought, you know, Python is simple and, I don't know, intuitive, but it was not the case, at least not for me.
I'm not a real Python expert. I'm probably similar to you. You know, I've used it at times because Python was the most logical thing, mm-hmm. or maybe it's got, maybe an LLM gave me a snippet and it's like, hey, you know, that's nice and contained. It's Python. Sure, we'll use that. Mm-hmm. Definitely, the external dependencies, like Java has a lot built into the runtime environment. Like you've got a whole bunch of goodies, which is one of the nice things with Java. Python, I guess, is, as far as simple goes, it's more the syntax that is claimed to be more like plain language, easier to, it's almost like English as far as you can go with
the... This surprises me because I don't like Python. I think Ruby is nicer. If you look at Ruby, so this is really stunning that Ruby is not as popular as Python because they were crazy popular with Ruby on Rails.
Yeah, and Ruby on Rails got really big for a while.
Yeah, and infrastructure as code were lots of Ruby projects. And then it still disappeared and Python took over. This is interesting. Why Ruby didn't want? Because I actually always wanted to learn Ruby, but Ozone didn't manage. There was too much Java going on. But I would be more motivated with Ruby than Python, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. I also like the syntax of Ruby a little bit better. I don't like the indentation. Like I like having
and the underscores. I think Python lots of underscores, right?
Yeah, lots of underscores. The snake case by default. Although I'm not really up on the best style guidelines for Ruby either. I think Ruby has a lot of underscore mm-hmm. going on there too. Mm-hmm. But what Ruby does have that I like is the end of, like, you get to the end of a function, it's got that end marker.
Okay.
Not just like it's de-indented. It's like there's a marker that it's over.
Back to you. Because we were in which year? I forgot now. We were talking about the your open source, and there's the most beautiful UI project called XataFace, right? Or ZataFace.
ZataFace.
ZataFace. Why the name ZataFace? Why?
Well, there is a story behind that. It used to be called DataFace, which is like a database. You put a face on your database. It makes sense. Then there happens to be a company in Texas called DataFace Computer Solutions. They do, I don't know, uh-huh. some sort of IT consulting. They were not building software. They were doing something else. But they sent me a strongly worded letter, and they told me to change my name. And the reason was that somebody, because I had dataface.com, I had data-face.com. They had dataface.com. And somebody had sent them a support request through email, saying, hey, we're having trouble with something in DataFace, and can you help me? And then they had wind of this project. They had their lawyers send me a strongly worded letter. And
how strongly was it? Like,
cease and desist. There was no numbers involved, but I pretty much decided that it'd be easier for me to just change the name. The classes, like if you look inside the source code, a lot of the classes still have DataFace. Because I wasn't going to do like a big refactor to like change
the names. Which is impossible in PHP, I guess, right?
Well, at the time, it was super impossible. Now it's actually like you just tell Claude to do it.
Yeah, of course. But I think they are around. They are in Houston, Texas.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I found them.
I hope they're successful. You know, I didn't mean them any harm.
No. Now it'd be even more successful because of the podcast. But
But yeah, so I changed it to ZataFace because I just couldn't. I liked the name DataFace, and I was like, well, let's cross out the D. And what does that become? It comes an X, and you can pronounce it.
This is actually a pretty cool story, Wizzy. And and why you started such projects? I mean,
I just love building things. I used. I guess part of it is things that I hate doing are the most likely things that I'm going to get involved in as for building a project for. And I hated writing boilerplate CRUD, and you needed to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I had also been exposed to FileMaker. So at the time, I was working in the Faculty of Education, and everybody used FileMaker. And I liked FileMaker. It was great for setting up databases that were really easy to use. But I wanted to use, if you get to a certain point with FileMaker, like you need a server, you have to buy the server license. You can't just do anything you want with it. You want to do something else, you got to buy a license for the next thing.
Is FileMaker actually good? Because
it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like as far as like if you're just a regular person, you're not a software developer, or if you are, you want to create a new database, it's create new database. You set up your tables and you want to create a form on that database to edit, you know, say you want a people database, you just drag your text. Here's your the name field, first name, last name. If there's a join to another table, you can create a portal, I think they called it. I might be wrong. It's sort of like a table that shows all the related rows and allows you to edit that. So if you're in education, and a lot of these things were databases that keep track of either professors or students, and maybe keeping track of the assignments that they've done, creating a really nice, easy to use interface was super easy. You've got reports built in. The editing, you can create different views to see your data differently. It was really nice, but I wanted to do it with PHP and MySQL so that I wasn't faced with needing to, because you need licenses. You can't you're beholden.
I think
to
right now FileMaker is an Apple company, right? They bought it.
I think, because it was Claris. There was a whole thing with Claris was Apple's sort of division for building this sort of thing. And then they branched it off to be just FileMaker. I'm not sure what the state is. And I haven't used it really since version 7, I think. Mm-hmm. Version 7 was the new one. And I would imagine they're up to like version 20 by now. Like this was back in around 2005 was my last exposure to it. And so I was influenced in this. I wanted to be able to, because I didn't want to be building things in FileMaker. I wanted to be building things like, you know, the proper way, just like you didn't like working in Flash. It felt like, I mean, when you're in FileMaker, you can write scripts, but you got to go through the GUI, you know, and it's similar to Flash. You got to sort of find, you know, where are these scripts, and it's not really made for scripting. It's a designer tool more. And I'm a developer. I wanted to be able to just work in the code. But on my job, I need to justify that. I can't say that, we could have a FileMaker database up in a week, or, hey, I want to build it in PHP and MySQL. I can do that in 2 months. That's just not going to fly. They just say, just do the FileMaker one. And so ZetaFace was about making it so I can build comparable
reuse,
things.
Basically, right? Speed up and reuse, and you could just contribute something back. You know, you had several clients, so yeah, exactly.
Yeah, more or less. Everything that was added to it, I could just reuse. You've got modules, and it just made it better and better so that it became faster to build something in ZetaFace than in FileMaker. And the usability was like going straight to the web, whereas FileMaker, you'd need the FileMaker client on each machine. So it actually eclipsed FileMaker for usability, and it became the sort of the standard for anything I built in the Faculty of Education. And then in Applied Sciences, another faculty I moved after, I built a bunch of things in ZetaFace for them. And
really spent lots of time at the university.
Yeah, I spent the first, up until Codename One, I had started wanting to do mobile development. Mm-hmm. And so I just after work, like I didn't need it for work when I was working at the university. I just, I just wanted to do it. And I had been doing stuff in Java already. I had a few apps and like desktop apps in like the App Store. And I wanted to use Java and I wanted to do mobile development. And so Codename One popped up. It was the very first thing. It was open source. And so I contributed a few things to that. And then they offered me a job. And it was tough at the time because I was very comfortable at the university. University is a great...
Which year was it, 2012?
It was probably 2012, if I had to think. It was around the time because when I went to Java 1 with Codename 1, it was as a... Like I was volunteering. They paid my Java 1 admission and I sort of helped them out at the booth. I wasn't actually working for them. And that is where they offered me the job. And it was a great experience. The time working at
2012. So the Java one was still big. I think 10,000-15,000 developers.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was that one or if it was the I'd gone to that one and I'd gone a couple of years before on my own, and they had Aerosmith performing. I don't know if you remember, like, that's how big this was. I guess it was more than just Java 1. They had like Oracle's Open World or something, but like they booked that whole
island. Okay, this was after 2010, but before 2010 is even bigger.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was 2000 and it was so big that there were more than 30,000 developers. But they were not allowed to say it because, as I know, the Moscone from the fire department perspective was only, you know, there were only 25 or 30,000 allowed. There were more than that. So it was crazy.
Oh, wow.
So it was Moscone, all Moscone's plus all the buildings around Moscone, which was Java 1.
Oh, that, I had a great time there both times. It was super fun. It was also interesting at the time that I went to see the difference between front-end Java, like the people that are into front-end Java, which I guess at the time was starting to wane, and back-end Java. Back-end Java, it just, front-end Java felt a completely different vibe than the back-end. You went into the back-end talks, it felt more like work, dreary work. And the front end, it felt more like there was a bunch of free spirits rolling into a presentation.
Yeah, it is true. So there were, you know, talks which, especially JavaFX, about Dribbble design. And there was the, you remember the, how it's called? Extreme GUI Makeover.
I remember.
Yeah, there was like a famous Swing session where they did impossible things with Swing. It looked just great. And
rings a bell. Yeah.
Yeah. What I found right now on your blog from December 24th, 2007, use of dataface trademark.
Oh, where, yeah, maybe I.
Yeah, it is. The entire letter is on your blog. It's interesting.
I've posted everything.
With address, the company name, it is in Houston, and even with the entire letter. So interesting.
Oh, watch, I'm going to get in trouble for that now. 2007.
But your blog looks actually nice.
Yeah, I've actually gone through, like, that's in WordPress. It's an older version that I've sort of just, like, I've crippled to make it harder to post in like, the name of security. And I got partway through exporting them out. I plan to, like, change it to a static site using one of the static tools like Jekyll or something like that. And Claude is the go-to thing. Was like, I think I pointed Claude to my blog and I said, export all of the articles out and preserve the links or something. It was just a very short thing. And it did it. I've got every one of those posts local in a Jekyll site, and it mostly works. I got onto other things, but I'll be replacing that blog with something static soon.
So Claude is your best friend right now?
Right now, it's, yeah, I guess. Although I got to say, the last couple of weeks, they've been having some difficulty. I've been building up in my own IDE. I've been building up the codec support. I'm forcing myself to do parity. When I add a feature for Claude, I make sure I add a feature for codec also.
What you can do, you can set up on AWS Cloud. You can pay per request for Claude, Opus, 4.6 and 4.7 even.
And oh, this is that like the Bedrock thing? Is that what
Bedrock? Bedrock. And it is far more stable than the official one, and more privacy. So for my clients, for instance, I only allow using that, and for Claude Code, no difference. So you can switch back and forth. So
can you use your Claude Code to like your Max subscription, or do you have to use the API?
You have to use the API, but it's not expensive. So I would say if you, maybe in your case, if you're working, you know, with multiple agents all the time in multiple, you know, for daily work, maybe you will pay, I don't know, $50 a month or something if you you just use it daily. This is not like, you know, crazy.
I'm doing the $300 Canadian. It's $200 the max plan.
Max, yeah, yeah. The difference is what I use Claude for is mostly microprofile in Java. And the cool story is because the LLMs were pre-trained on this data, you don't need a lot of tokens. So I would say the more esoteric language you're using, the more you are paying. In my case, it already knows. I have almost no skills, nothing. It just knows Java. This is why. But you can try it. So if you know, because you can switch as emergency to Bedrock, and you can just script it. So what you only need is API key. It's like a matter of 10 minutes, and you have it.
And that, but when you're using the Bedrock, I don't imagine you can use Claude Code with that. Are you using it?
It's officially. If you go to Claude Code and search Claude Code Bedrock, this is officially documented by Anthropic.
Oh.
Yeah. This is official configuration. There's actually for you nothing to do almost. The only difference is you need three environment variables. And if Claude Code sees the variables, the only difference will be you will see API usage or whatever, so it will change, you know, but it will
which can be significant. I have noticed when I do use the API in Claude, at least I'm shocked. It's like I do one request, it's like $2.50. Are you kidding me? What, I'm gonna be broke by the end of the week. But
you can set up how it's called alerts. You say, okay.
To let you know.
Yeah. But I was surprised. For my project, it was really cheap. So it really depends. But you are using, I don't know what they are doing. Of course, if you know, exporting the, rewriting your entire block history.
I've been pretty audacious with some of the, sometimes just like, what? I'll use the mobile app. Sometimes I'll just be sitting around and I'll be like, make something. It should be like this site. Except it's going to be for this crowd, and it's going to and you just get it to build this like an entire app or an entire like I had it write a 200 page ASCII doc manual for one of these libraries that I built. It's like make a plan, then write it, and I did that all while I'm waiting for my kids at dance. I just pull out my phone and I'll just say, hey, you know, make a developer guide for this, make a plan for it, and then go through. And it's like a 200 page thing, and it's good. It's
the I don't know what's your experience is. What I was stunned how well Claude Code or Claude, not Claude Code, and ChatGPT and even Mistral understand Java. So I'm the backend guy. And they never hallucinated on the annotations. So they always did the right thing. Of course, sometimes they misunderstood me, but from the infrastructural perspective, it was almost perfect. And then I said, this is impossible, because I would expect some hallucinations. And what I did is I played around with Swift UI in Xcode. So I opened Xcode and now used the official Apple way, no Claude Code, just in Xcode. And use the same model, I think even Bedrock, so I can remember. But I use exactly the same model. It was Opus 4.6 or 4.5 back then. And it's a completely different experience. So it hallucinated right away. So it couldn't build its own stuff. And I just created an Hello World, more or less, Swift UI application. So it means it took also longer. And I think it burned more token. So it worked at the end of the day. But it was not as smooth as Java, which was surprising. This is also your experience. So if you're leaving the Java path, it gets worse.
I could be biased because I do more Java than anything else. Like, but I do, you know, I've been doing Go with it. I've been doing JavaScript with it, PHP, Java. Mm-hmm. I have no complaints with Java. And I have a theory that it's not just that the Java is... it's trained. There's so many Java examples. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of it, or that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that it's so self-reinforcing. Like if it hallucinates, the test is just going to fail to compile, or the test is going to well, I mean, you can have tests in anything, but definitely the type safety that, mm-hmm. that Java has makes it so it'll just correct itself. It's like, oh, I thought that, you know, I made this up and apparently it doesn't exist. So
what I'm interested in is writing perfect Java code in huge projects. And this is what I'm what I'm experimented a lot with the LLMs, or because most of my commercial projects are also big, and my clients are enterprise clients, so it's interesting knowledge. And what I ask the LLMs, and also what I'm doing is, if you add your own business annotations with Minik on the code, it gets even better. So the LLMs really like annotations because it's type safe; they can read that. And I spend more time with JavaDoc. And if you put JavaDoc, nice JavaDoc, so I tell LLMs never write stupid JavaDoc forgetters and setters. So if you write something, you know, document the intent, background knowledge, or why you're doing this. And they are writing a really good JavaDoc. And I force them to create package info JavaDoc on package level. And the cool story, if you do this, you can start with Claude code, then switch the LLM, open with another one, and they get it. So they already know what's going on. And what I try to avoid is external dependencies, because what I observe is if you put, you know, your dependencies too many libraries, first you have to maintain them. But what they will do is they use Java P to decompile the library and see what's going on. So this takes too long. But if you have no external dependencies, they exactly know, okay, this is Java, and they know it. And this works better and better. So actually it scales linearly. And what I do, you have to try it. So I ask them, how many tokens we are saving with this approach actually? Because, you know, we are using Java, you are on pre-trained knowledge, just standards, and stunning between 50 and 80%. This was actually the answer from LLMs, and they did the math and show, okay, why? What is the case? How big is my context? How many skills are loaded? You know, and looked reasonable. So 80%, I don't believe, but still, I believe that there is a lot actually, which is good for us or for Java fanboys and fangirls, because lots of my clients notice that because the Claude Code Max is not available for enterprises, so they have to pay it, and with Java, you can save a huge amount of inference money, actually.
That makes sense. So when you asked it, like, how much am I saving it, compared to what? Like, which practice were you talking about? The package info or the not doing
dependencies? So, by the way, we stopped at Codename 1. So I will re-invite you back, and we will talk about Codename 1 a bit, and then JDeploy, of course. So this was actually the entire idea for today, to talk about JDeploy, but you are two interesting guys, so we spend time just chatting, but it's not a problem. I re-invite you back and have a nice chat about JDeploy and your current Java projects, journeys. And what I do, all my projects, so all my projects look the same for years, and this is like no dependencies, usually MicroProfile in Jakarta-E, and right now everything is Quarkus. Because Quarkus is fast, we can save memory, and it starts fast. It's good for serverless, for Lambdas, AWS Lambdas. And this is Quarkus with the Jakarta structure. And the cool story is, you remember maybe JSRs, Java Specification Requests. This was like, you know, how JPA was documented, and Java Server Faces, which is no more there almost. Then bean validation and stuff. Everything was specified in a normative language. And because it was always open, LLMs just read it. And so what I ask LLM is like, so I work with the application. So it's I create a new component. And also for the component, I use an old pattern called BCE, Boundary Control Entity. It was actually very popular in front ends. It was coined by Ericsson. This is 1992, very old. But the LLMs also know it. So, and if they know it, so I don't need any skills, nothing. I just say, you know, create a BC, I don't know, teacher, and it will do it. And after a while, I say, look, now this project was based on standards. It was based on that. So if we wouldn't use standards and know Java rather than something else, so how much we would save? And just something else. What I usually do, I'm not interested in something else. I was more interested, you know, if I wouldn't use the standards, just plain Java, how much tokens will I save? And this is already stunning. It was already says like 30% or something like this.
Well, I believe it. And I definitely have noticed like the dependency things, like trying to decompile some of the dependencies. And I've had to stop Claude several times. I have the belief that probably there's something I can do, like when I can add something to the Claude file to tell it never do that or something. But it is, you know, it's a challenge why I do want to like not just let it go. You know, when you start looking, it's like, what are you doing? No, stop.
My trick was I'm grounding the LLM. So I tell the LLM in a minimal skill, you're only allowed to use the official APIs. If you generate the code, just official APIs. So it generates the source code against MicroProfile API, but it runs on Quarkus. And this was the question. I say, if I would say just generate Quarkus code, then the problem is there are 30 different possibilities to have one application. You know, reactive, non-reactive, virtual threads, non-reactive. This is like stuff which there are too many possibilities to implement a single application. But in the Jakarta-E way, this is actually the skill itself because there's only one path. So if you would like to expose an HTTP endpoint, the only way to do this, you put an at path on a class and at get on a method, and this is the only way, right? And on Quarkus, you could use reactive routes, you can use this, you can use REST easy without that. So there are like a five possibilities to achieve the same.
I'll have to give that a try. So MicroProfile, because I've listened to your podcast before.
Oh, and, if you go to airails.dev, and there AI is one Rails skill called MicroProfile Server. And in this MicroProfile Server skill, if you open that, you will see, it's just like exactly what I said. You are not allowed to, you know, this is more no. Never generate more than three unit tests. Never do whatever.
Is this yours or is somebody else set this up?
This is my.
Oh.
I started last year. And I got so many requests whether I will publish that. And the problem is I only had Claude MD, you know, the memory with like 500 rules. Everything was there from web component, CSS to Java. And I didn't want it to publish that. And then what I did is, okay, if I will publish it, I will have, you know, to refactor this and remove all the duplications. And this is what had happened. And now I modularized the stuff. AIRails.dev.
Usage copies your skills. Hey. Yeah, I'll have to give that a try. I went through some exercises on my parental leave trying to beef up my ability to deploy server-side stuff. Like JDeploy sort of solved if I want to build a tool that I
roll then out. What do you have to know? Maybe I will have to write it. So as a tutorial, brownfield project is better than greenfield. And what I also do, if you go to my GitHub account, there is Quarkus MicroProfile. And this project is more or less empty. There is just like one health check. And this is the starting point. Because if you don't have the starting point, it will manage to do that. But it will try, you know, to invent the POM, whatever, from the beginning. It's just a waste of tokens and time. But if you go to the Quarkus MicroProfile, it's just like already set up with the main project and system tests. And I'm really, really curious about your feedback. If you do this, we can talk about this next time. And I can improve it whatever you like. Because I'm... For me, I do it all the time, right?
Well, one place I got stuck with Quarkus because I was curious about trying to deploy to Lambdas or Cloud Run, and because I wanted to be able to deploy to Zero, like I'm talking about deploying side projects. Mm-hmm. I got tons of these things,
yeah.
Especially with AI, these pop out of your head. You create something in a day, but you don't want to be spending $40 a month per side project. I don't want to spend anything if nobody's using it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, Quarkus sounds good. I've used Quarkus for a lot of things. It starts up real quick. I like the that it's very similar to Spring Boot, but the faster startup. Mm-hmm. It was very nice. But I had some trouble doing the deployments to Cloud Run. Probably because I didn't understand some of these things. At first, I'd fall back to like, oh, let's just start deploy it as JVM just to see what's a cold start on just deploying it with JVM, not doing the Graal native image, but just like JVM.
Yeah, exactly. I never used the Graal image.
You never did because how do you get Well, I was getting like 30-second cold starts.
Which
was
so. What I give send you in the chat is one URL is called constructions.cloud, and this constructions.cloud is Quarkus with serverless CDK, Cloud Development Kit. So you only need an AWS account, and it will publish in Lambda with your code. So it is like very simple. So in one of my podcasts, there was a lawyer, 75 years old lawyer on the podcast. And he wanted to create a startup, a software startup, because he retired. And he used that, and it works. So it is like, it is, I think, the simplest possible thing. You only need the credentials, Maven, and it works.
And how is it deploying it? Does it?
As an AWS Lambda.
But, I mean, is it creating a Docker image? Is it
zip.
Doing like...
No. Just zip. There is no Docker on Lambda. This is zip, publishes the zip. Startup time expected is like the first one would be 3 seconds. And
I must have been doing it totally wrong.
And so... subsequent startup time, I expect 1 to 2 seconds. And if it has to be faster, you can buy provision concurrency, but then you will pay $15 a month. But if you have lots of traffic, it's going to be cheaper because the subsequent requests are getting cheaper. But I give you a tip. What you can do, right? You can have a cron job, which pings the Lambda every minute, and there will be never a cold start.
Oh yeah, but then you got to pay.
No. Because 1 million requests are free, and if you do the math, this is the one request every minute. You're still in the free tier.
Oh, okay.
You see the tips? This is next time you give me some swing tips because I forgot.
I got lots of tips, but that's a good one because I was using.
Wait a second, because I forget. If you ship Quarkus with 2 gigs of RAM, this is my standard calculation because the question all the time for all my clients, and 2 gigs RAM and 2 transactions per second the entire month, which is a lot. 2 transactions per second because Quarkus responds as Lambda usually under 100 milliseconds, like 10 milliseconds or whatever. So, you will pay $14. So this is, you know, if you ping, you know, the Quarkus every minute, you will pay nothing, basically. And you have never a cold start.
Oh. Yeah, I'll have to try that out. I guess I was spending most of my time with Cloud Run.
I have like no idea about Cloud Run. Never tested. This is but Cloud Run AWS or Google?
Google. So it's Google's answer to Lambdas.
But on AWS is not Cloud Run, AppRunner. So this is the AppRunner. Because most of my clients use AWS and then Azure Function, the same story, and Google is less popular in Europe. I would say, so this is why.
Okay, we'll have to. Spend some time with Lambda.
Sorry that we didn't cover the JDeploy. But you are invited back. So first, where people can find you, where they can find JDeploy, because they have to prepare for our next discussion. I cannot promise you whether we'll cover JDeploy. It's way too interesting, everything else. But we will a little bit cover Codename 1, Swing, JavaFX, and JDeploy, because I also like
sounds good
Java frontend and your IDE maybe, you know.
We'll see if that's ready to share.
But you could actually create a GitHub project just for fun. So why not?
Yeah, right? I could. Like, it is on GitHub. It's just a private one right now that I haven't shared. When I decide to put it out, like, JDeploy will make it instantly, like, you'll be able to install it. Like, it won't be a big thing to publish it.
Maybe you will like what I am doing on GitHub. So what I do is I have an agent, pure Java agent without dependencies, is Mr. Smith, Z Smith. And I have a lot of Java scripts, like Java 25 scripts, so you don't have to compile them. It's called Zeed. So if you go to my GitHub account and search for just Adam Bean, I put it, of course, in the show notes, and then add the
ZB.
Just Z, like zero dependency. This
I see. That's why all these Z's are showing up.
Yeah, this is the Z,
Z's, as we say in Canada.
Z. So this is ZZ top or ZZ top in Canada?
We say ZZ top for...
In Canada, not ZZ top. Band.
Yeah, no.
They're also from Texas.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess we go by, you know, they wanted to be called ZZ top. That's fine. But like the Camaro, you know, the Z28.
Uh-huh.
Do you call it a Z28? Do people actually do that or...
I don't know. I never heard about the Camaro.
Maybe in Europe the Chevys aren't as big a thing.
No, we don't have any Chevys.
Which one was it? Z?
Just Z. This is like reference to many projects without dependencies. It's like Portal. And I give it also reference to the
Zero
agent.
Zero dependency Java projects. There we go.
Yeah, this is like whatever is useful. I also publish it to similar, you know, to share it and be able to quickly clone it. And yeah.
Well,
it was really fun to meet you after all these years. And thank you. And where people can find you, give me some references to your blog, your name, JDeploy, your services, whatever you like.
Well, okay. Well, the JDeploy site is jdeploy.com. And I've got a blog at sjhannah.com. My last name is a palindrome. It's H-A-N-N-A-H.
That's so cool.
So, and then SJ are my initials. So sjhannah.com is, that's my blog that I try to update from time to time, but I haven't updated in a while. But
Claude
I'll
can
post.
Do this, right? Sorry, Claude, yeah, updates. Write something reasonable today.
I've made sort of an internal policy of myself that at least for my personal blog and like for the JDeploy, I've got a newsletter, and those I will never use AIs to write those. Those I want to write myself. For documentation, like I had to make a choice because I've started to write, getting Claude to write a lot like release notes, updating the manual, these sorts of things I'm getting Claude to do. And so I've changed it, like the developer guide says the author. What's the author? And now I, when I get Claude to do it, I say JDeploy team. You know,
oh, yeah, perfect.
Just to try to signify, it's like, this isn't me. This is AI. But it's terrifying. AI is eating everything. But
You know the movie A-Team?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This is AI team. You know, you can say, okay, there was the A-Team.
But yeah, so those are two places to get started there. Talk about ZetaFace, ZetaFace.com.
Can someone buy JDeploy? You have something to sell?
Not yet, but I'm working on, that's part of me working on the server side. So I'm working on enterprise-y type stuff so that there is a higher tier for somebody. But right now it's free.
Then maybe it is useful, you know, the backends from me. So I'm really curious about your opinion, whether it's useful or not.
Like that's
AI rails, you know, the skills and whatever, and the Quarkus micro profile plain project. If you download that and then open Claude Code there and use the skill, I think you should get.
Get something that's working the way you're describing it on Lambda, that would be a big watershed because I've resorted.
This works in 5 minutes. If you had time, we could do during the podcast. If you go to the constructions cloud, I know that this works because the simplest one is AWS Lambda function URL, the second one with Quarkus. The only downside is with that you get an ugly URL. So this is the only thing. And
I think a lot of times with backend, that's no big deal.
Yeah, but it's the cheapest one because you need anything. There are no additional costs.
Yeah.
And the AWS Quarkus Lambda HTTP API with CDK, it is more serious one because you get the API gateway, so you get versioning, you can have additional authorization, and you can have nice DNS names, whatever you like. So I would start with the second one. It's called AWS Lambda Function URL with Quarkus and CDK. And this AWS Quarkus Lambda HTTP API with CDK is the,
I'll definitely play with those.
And there's one with S3 integration, one with, you know, agent core for agents. So the if I have some, this is like ZetaFaces. And this is like the case for me because if I start a project, I just clone it for my clients and go with it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. Like what I have resorted to is I set up like a new Tom EE server to deploy some stuff by Wart, like because I just got to the point where I couldn't get it working the way I wanted to with a cold start. I'm like, you know what? WARs were great. Just like I have it set up with, I've got a repository with my infrastructure, Terraform, and then use a little bit of Ansible to
the cool story is you don't need Terraform here. The CDK is just Java. So the entire infrastructure is pure Java.
And it's still infrastructure as code.
Yeah, and better than Terraform, easier to get. And it's no external dependencies, just AWS. Enterprisey. Thank you a lot. See you next time.
Yeah, it's good talking to you, Adam. Thanks for having me.